From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the life of one teenaged mother. We talk with Letitia Johnson. She had her first child at the age of 16. Her mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother also had their first babies when they were teenagers. Letitia is now a recovering crack addict. Her family is the subject of a new book about teenage mothers. Also today, the Dream Warriors, a rap group with a record about the rapper's mother's favorite dance tune, not your typical gangster rap. The Dream Warriors are from Canada's community of Caribbean emigres. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Memories of MASH, tonight's retrospective on one of TV's most popular series. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israel said today that it will not negotiate issues of substance with its Arab neighbors until they agree to move the peace talks to the Middle East. The statement was apparently intended to express Israel's anger at the U.S. announcement that the next round of talks would be held in Washington on December 4th. Diplomats say they still expect Israel to come to the Washington talks, but to insist that they be confined to procedural matters. Sources close to the Palestinian negotiating team said that their spokeswoman, Hanan Ashrawi, has accepted the invitation in principle if officials of the PLO are given U.S. entry visas. Salvadoran government and rebel negotiators began their latest round of peace talks in Mexico today. Both sides agree that this is the decisive round aimed at ending the 12-year-old civil war. Sandina Robbins reports.
The war in El Salvador, which has claimed 75,000 lives, could come to an end by mid-December. Both government and rebel leaders agree that the talks are at a crucial stage after more than a year and a half of UN mediation. How to demilitarize the war-torn Central American country is still being worked out, but they have agreed to reduce the powerful armed forces and create a national civilian police incorporating rebel soldiers. Land reform is also central to the signing of a peace settlement. Rebel negotiators want the government's assurance that territories they control will be turned over to poor farmers and not returned to their wealthy landowners. For National Public Radio, I'm Sandina Robbins in Mexico City.
Amnesty International has accused all sides in the Yugoslav conflict of committing atrocities and has appealed to the Serbians and Croatians to treat prisoners humanely and protect civilians. The 14-page report, issued today in London, is Amnesty International's first detailed look at the fighting in Yugoslavia. The BBC's Mark Brain reports.
The organization says it's collected well-documented evidence proving that over the past 4 months of conflict, there'd been blatant violations on all sides of the Geneva Conventions forbidding murder and mistreatment. Among the many thousands who'd already died, Amnesty speaks of arbitrary and deliberate killings of both unarmed civilians and of surrendered or wounded fighters. It chronicles cases of torture and mutilation and calls on all parties to abide by international law on the humane treatment of prisoners and the protection of non-combatants. In one instance, it says more than 20 people were reported to have died in the village of Cetekovac in Croatia when Serbian paramilitary shot dead five elderly women and stabbed to death a 65-year-old man.
The BBC's Mark Brain in London. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about a point to finish the day at 2,902. Declines led advances by a margin of 5-3 in active trading. This is NPR News. The AFL-CIO and a national consumers group called today for a nationwide boycott of Chinese-made toys. The union group and the National Consumers League claim that toys are among the Chinese export products that are made using forced labor and child labor. Spokespeople for the group said that more than half of all dolls and more than 40% of other toys sold in the United States come from China. Toy industry officials oppose the so-called toycott, saying that Chinese toys sold in the United States are made by ordinary adult Chinese workers. Although House and Senate negotiators approved a crime bill last night, it appears that it will not become law this year. President Bush has threatened to veto the bill, which Republicans say has been weakened so much it favors criminals. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
President Bush has been demanding that Congress give him a crime bill at every available opportunity. Congress is on the verge of passing a crime bill now that Democrat Charles Schumer says is everything the president wanted.
President Bush got what he asked for, and now he's stuck. The bottom line is this crime bill is the toughest crime bill that Congress has passed in a decade, and the president says he's going to veto it. Why?
Republicans were overridden on key provisions that would limit death row appeals and give police more latitude to introduce evidence in court that was seized without a warrant. Now they say the best course is to kill the bill, which will make it a major campaign issue for 1992. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The Federal Pension Insurance Agency said today that underfunded pension plans are up by almost 50% from last year. The Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation released its annual list of the 50 largest underfunded pension plans and said they have a potential combined shortfall of more than $21 billion. The list includes companies such as National Steel, LTV, and Uniroyal Goodrich. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's difficult for many of us to understand why a 15-year-old girl would feel ready to be a mother, especially if that teenager is from a family in which several generations of women became mothers in their teens and suffered great hardships. When my guest Letitia Johnson became a mother at the age of 16, she was continuing a pattern established by her mother, her grandmother, and great-grandmother. These four women are profiled in a new book called Before Their Time, Four Generations of Teenaged Mothers, by Joelle Sander. Letitia's name is a pseudonym she used for the book. Letitia left home at the age of 13 to get away from her stepfather, who sexually and physically abused her. She lived with her grandmother until she was 15 and then moved in with her boyfriend and his family. That's when she decided she wanted to have a baby. Many of us assume most teenage pregnancies are accidents. But Letitia told me she wanted to have a baby because she envied her pregnant girlfriend.
Well, I seen the relationship that she had with her boyfriend, the closeness, and we are both the same age. And when she told me she was pregnant, I kind of was jealous because I was like, hey, you have a boyfriend and you're getting ready to have a baby. And it seemed so beautiful because I'm on the outside looking in. And so I decided, well, this is something that I want too. You know, I want to have a baby. I want the house and the white picket fence too. And it wasn't like that.
Had you been using birth control before you decided you wanted to have a baby?
Well, yeah, I believe so. I was using the pill and I had stopped. I had stopped using, but I told my boyfriend I was using it.
Why did you not tell him the truth?
Because he didn't want to have a child, and I had to talk him into it, you know. And
did you think that was fair to him?
No, I don't think it was fair to him, because he suffered in the long run, you know, as well as I did, you know. No, I don't think it was fair.
When you did become pregnant, most of the women in your family advised you to have an abortion.
Yeah, they did, but I'm against abortions because I have my own personal views about abortions, and I refuse to give up a life. This is a life that I feel me and the father had created, and I didn't feel that I should destroy this life.
Did your mother and grandmother and great-grandmother, who had each become mothers when they were teenagers, did they tell you stories about the hardships that they had faced as teenage mothers?
No, I never knew their story until I read it in the book Before Their Time.
Really?
Yes.
Why do you think they never told you?
Well, see, I believe it has a lot to do with their ages and the way they were raised. This is something you just don't talk about, you know, All I ever knew about my grandmother was that she had a hard life coming up in a depression, didn't know where her next meal was coming from, and she used to always preach to me about getting a good education and being somebody in life, and that's basically all she ever told me.
So what was your reaction when you read the book and found out that in some ways their stories were really similar to yours?
I was shocked. I couldn't believe my grandmother went through this and my great-grandmother. I couldn't believe it. They never appeared to be the type of women that would go through something like this, you know. Especially my grandmother having to put her first child in a foundling home and then get her out after she got married. I couldn't believe this, you know. These are two strong women who been through so much, and this was the last thing I ever expected to find out. I didn't believe it really until, like, I read it in a book, and then I asked questions.
Did you feel that people looked down on you? Are there friends or teachers or neighbors, you know, and that you were going to become something of an outcast because you became pregnant at the age of 15? Was that looked down on?
No. You could say about 40% of my school were pregnant mothers. It seemed like it was okay, you know. There was no one who looked down on me or anybody else. All you see was a bunch of pregnant girls walking around high school. And I went to Norman Thomas High School, which is one of the good schools in New York.
Did most of the girls who became teenage mothers leave school?
Well, some completed school. Some went through to 12th grade and graduated pregnant and all. Some had their babies and still completed school. I know for myself, I left.
Letitia, you split up with your boyfriend after your son was born, and you ended up moving into an apartment across the street from your mother's. One of your girlfriends moved in, and her boyfriend was a crack dealer, and he got you hooked. What did you like about crack? That might sound like a foolish and obvious question, but you know, I'd be interested in hearing what you had to say about it.
It's so funny. Well, let me clarify something.
Yeah, please.
I was before she even moved in, and before I even moved into the apartment, I was indulging in cocaine and marijuana before I started smoking crack. So I was already in the drug scene. So like when they first moved in, marijuana was smoked, you know, in the house. So when I first smoked it, it didn't taste right. It didn't seem right. It wasn't the same. Until I found out that he had put some crack in the marijuana, which to me, when I smoked it, I felt like all my problems were gone. I didn't have nothing to think about. It was like I was in heaven, you know. I didn't have to face reality no more. I didn't have to take on any responsibilities. I could just do nothing all day. And everything was fine. Everything was okay as far as I was concerned.
When did the reality of paying for the drug start to get to you?
Wow, that was after the people in my house left. Because what happened was, during the time that they were staying with me, my addiction had progressed to the point where I was stealing cocaine, I was stealing money, I was stealing crack to get high, because that's how much I was addicted to it. And then once they found out, I had both my arms broken and stitches in my head. And I was in so much pain then. When they left, I didn't know whether to continue or to stop. It didn't really teach me a lesson because I continued to use it. And then when I gave up my son, that was the most painful thing that I ever had to face.
You gave custody of your son to your...
to his paternal aunt.
Right. And Letitia, after you became addicted and you needed money really badly, you started prostituting.
Yes.
Did you know how to do it without being part? I mean, you didn't have a pimp. You weren't part of like an organized group or anything. I mean,
No.
I know this might sound ludicrous.
No, it doesn't, because I want to explain this to you. And I want to tell you why and how it brought me to being, well, we say tricking on the streets, but yeah, being a prostitute was because I've always felt when I was being sexually molested that it was okay. And I was getting money for it when I was living at home.
Your father would give you money after you molested
him? Yeah, he would give me money. He would buy me clothes, which I thought was okay. Like I said, it was all right for me to do this. And so I says, well, since he did it to me, what makes it any different if I go out in the street? So that's what I did.
Mm-hmm. Did you use contraception when you were tricking?
No.
How come? Because you knew about.
Well, sometimes I did. Wait a minute. Sometimes I did. I mean, as far as condoms is concerned, yes. But see, let me explain something. When a woman's on crack, especially crack, I'm going to get into real further detail as far as crack and a woman's body is concerned. Some women's hormones are different, whereas they'll stop having a menstrual, you know, for periods of time. And I went without a menstrual for a long time. So I wasn't able to get pregnant, you know. And that was good for me. That was a plus for me. And as far as the condoms was concerned, I used them just to keep from getting any kind of venereal disease, which on occasions I did contract a venereal disease, you know.
Were you worried about AIDS? And were the men who...
I didn't know anything about no AIDS.
You didn't know about it then? This was like the mid-80s, 85, 86.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about AIDS. Well, now I do. Since I'd say, I'm going to jump forward, since 1988 and 89, I had been tested, and I continually get tested. And so far, so good. I'm negative. You know, because that was my biggest worry when I stopped using and I started getting clean, was that would I get the AIDS virus? You know, mm-hmm. That's been a big issue in my life.
My guest is Letitia Johnson. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Letitia Johnson. Her family is the subject of the new book, Before Their Time, Four Generations of Teenage Mothers. The first time you were on drugs and what, you know, when you started working as a prostitute, it was 1985 to 86, mm-hmm. And you had given up custody of your son, but then you decided you wanted to have another child.
Okay, well, at that time, I believe I went into a drug rehab,
mm-hmm.
And I was doing great, you know, but I was messing with the guy that lived across the street, and this was not a planned pregnancy like my first one. This was not a pregnancy that I wanted. I decided that I was gonna do this again. You know, no one was gonna take her from me. I wasn't gonna mess up. I was going to take care of her. And as far as the father was concerned, well, he really didn't want to have anything to do with it. So I said, fine. You know, I'll do what I have to do.
How did you get back on crack?
Well, after she was born, I got custody of my son back. And I was working, I was going to school, and I stopped going to school to work. And it was difficult because I was taking my son downtown to school and picking him up after work. And then I was also seeing a guy that was in prison. And he had me bringing him drugs, you know, marijuana in the prison. And I wasn't getting high at the time. And so one day I just decided, I got fed up with a lot of pressure. It was a lot of pressure, running back and forth, trying to do so many things. Till I just got to the point when I got paid one day, I just went around the corner. And then it just so happens I run into somebody that I know who gets high off a crack and said, come on. And it's just that easy.
During this period when you were addicted to crack, you were homeless, what got you out of that? What turned things around?
Okay, well, let me just tell you, I did go into a second program, and I went into the rehab at Project Contact Pride Site, and I was doing real good. Of course, again, I had a jacket for men. Oh, I don't know how this happens to me, but I left again, and then I continued on doing drugs until... my brother, him and his wife were going to North Carolina. I mean, actually Florida, but they stayed in North Carolina. And they asked me, did I want to go with them? So I was like, well, this is something I've dreamed for. I said, if I could get away from New York, period, I'd be fine. And I did. I left with them on my son's birthday, July 27th, 1989. And, I went down to Wilson, North Carolina. And when I went down there, I was doing wonderful. Of course, I did indulge in drugs one time while I was down there. But I knew at that time that I was down there for a purpose. I had an opportunity here, and I didn't want to mess this up. So I did everything I had to do in order to stay clean and to get things that I needed to get.
Let's talk about what your situation is now. Mm-hmm. You've given up crack.
Yes.
You're married now?
Yes.
And you have a third child?
Yes.
Who is how old?
Who's 13 months.
And how are things different for you this time around as a mother?
Well, first of all, as a mother, I really never thought about how different it is now being a mother. I find myself much closer to my children. I think a lot about the consequences of me getting high, the things that happened to me. I'm a part of Narcotics Anonymous, and... I have been taught a lot, you know, that I have to keep all of the things that I've gone through up front and keep it green for me so that I can remember where I came from.
Are your other two children living with you now?
Yes.
So you have custody of all of your children?
Well, my son just got killed in a car accident this past summer.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Thank you. So I just have the two girls. Let me just state this. And even at the time when my son did, get killed, his funeral was in an area where, like right down the block, I started getting high for the third time. And for the second and the third time. And it was very hard for me, but when I looked down that block and I looked at his casket, I knew that I was doing the right things. And when he left me knowing that I was clean and sober and I was not where they would have to come look for me and find me to come to his funeral. I felt good about him leaving me the way I was. You know, I would have been very devastated and probably not been sitting here if I had been on drugs, you know. But I feel good knowing that we shared a lot. We got to know each other. The girls loved him, you know, and I miss him a lot, but I have to go on with my life, you know. So I think about that a lot. If I got high, I would just be taking a whole lot of steps backwards, and I'm trying to go forward.
Letitia, what has the experience been like of reading your own story in a book?
Well, it's amazing. What can I say? It's really amazing. I really never thought that it would go this far. You know, when Joelle called me when I got back here to New York, well, actually, I called her when I got back to New York, and I told her I was pregnant and everything. And she was telling me about the book. I was amazed. I was like, it's almost ready. I mean, it's I don't know. And reading the book, like I said, there was a lot of things I didn't know my grandmother was going through. Emotionally and mentally, as far as the things I was doing, which made me really cry because it hurt me to know that I put her through a lot of emotional feelings and mental in a mental state that she couldn't even think right, you know.
Letitia, one last question for you. Mm-hmm. If you knew somebody who was 15, the age you were when you...
You must be on the same wavelength that I'm on. I was just sitting here thinking, I have a total of, plus myself would make seven, six sisters and brothers, three girls and three boys. I have a sister who is 17. And she's read the book. And so far, you know, she uses discretion with her boyfriends. I'm very pleased to see that she wants to get an education. But if it was a 15-year-old girl who was in a predicament or a situation where she felt she had nobody or she wanted to love somebody, I'd tell her to love herself and try to go on and do the things that you like to do. Peer pressure. Everybody sees everybody else doing things and everybody wants to follow along behind somebody. And I think sometimes you need to have your own mind and your own decisions and your own way you want to go. I feel that you should love yourself and you should be whatever you can possibly be in life and have goals in mind and try to accomplish those goals. And that's it.
Letitia Johnson. Her family is the subject of the new book Before Their Time, Four Generations of Teenage Mothers by Joelle Sander. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a definition of a bombastic jazz style. We meet King Lou of the rap group The Dream Warriors. He's originally from the Caribbean and grew up in a Toronto housing project. Also, a TV series that was so popular, they're still making programs about it. TV critic David Bianculli has a review of Memories of MASH. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Moscow, Soviet President Gorbachev and the leaders of seven Soviet republics have ended talks on a new Union Treaty, without that accord being initialed as planned. After failing to reach agreement, the parties decided that the Soviet federations should discuss the matter further. Tim Hewell of the BBC describes what went wrong at today's meeting.
I think maybe Mr. Gorbachev was rather over-optimistic in believing that the thing could be signed or initialed today in the first place. There isn't really even agreement on such a basic point as whether this new Union of Sovereign States, as it's going to be called, should be an international organization, rather like, for example, the European Community, or whether it should be a single state in its own right and a subject of international law, like, for example, the United States of America. And without firm consensus on an issue as central as that, it's very, very hard to see how the Republican leaders could have initialed it today. There's still no real agreement on how many central institutions this new union should have, nor is there a final agreement, for example, on whether the new union should have a constitution. With such basic sticking points as this, it would have been very hard, I think, to reach agreement yet.
Tim Hewell of the BBC in Moscow. In New York City, the UN Security Council is considering a plan to send UN peacekeeping forces to Yugoslavia. This comes as the latest truce in the Yugoslav conflict appears to be holding in most places. More from NPR's Jim Zeroli at the UN.
Over the weekend, UN envoy Cyrus Vance met in Geneva with leaders of the warring Yugoslavian factions. They assured Vance they want peacekeeping troops in their country, and UN officials say it appears likely some kind of force will be deployed. But important questions remain about where it will be stationed. UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar reiterated today that a force would be sent only if the latest ceasefire holds. This afternoon, the Security Council met formally to discuss the Yugoslavian crisis for the first time in 2 weeks. The Council may also discuss a European proposal to impose an oil embargo on Yugoslavia, but the idea has encountered considerable resistance from some Council members. At the UN, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
The Coast Guard picked up more than 1,100 more Haitian boat people over the weekend, bringing the number now held on U.S. Coast Guard boats to more than 2,600. A spokesman says that the service is running out of space to handle the large number of people fleeing their country. Since the end of October, the Coast Guard says 4,500 boat people have been picked up. A temporary court order issued last week in Miami has stopped the return of Haitians to their homeland. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down less than 1 point to close at 2,902.06 in active trading. This is NPR News. So far, only Jordan and Lebanon have told the State Department that they plan to take part in the next round of Middle Eastern peace talks set for next week in Washington. It has been 3 weeks since the first set of talks was held, and there has been disagreement over the site for the next set. Last week, Secretary of State Baker told U.S. embassies in the Middle East to inform government leaders the talks would resume in Washington December 4th, and today was set as a deadline for accepting. Israeli officials have indicated that they felt that their prime minister was treated rudely on his Washington visit last week. On Capitol Hill, House and Senate conferees have started efforts to work out a compromise banking bill. This measure would authorize the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation to borrow up to $70 billion to shore up the fund that guarantees investors' deposits. NPR's Brian Naylor has more.
The House and Senate agree the FDIC needs the money, but disagree on other provisions. The Senate wants to allow banks to open up interstate branch networks and cap credit card interest rates. The new chairman of the FDIC, William Taylor, told the Senate Banking Committee today his top priority is to replenish the deposit insurance fund.
The message I've been trying to convey is that the money is needed. The money is needed now.
Taylor said the FDIC has had to put off closing some dying banks because only $2 billion remain in the insurance fund. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Thomas Sutherland is back in the United States 1 week after he was freed by his captors in Lebanon. Sutherland told reporters today that he is still hopeful about the release of other Western hostages, even though he said they are running a little late, which he said was not unusual for that group. He had hoped to leave Germany last Thursday, but he was held longer after doctors found that he was suffering from an ulcer. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. As our rock critic Ken Tucker likes to point out, all rap doesn't sound the same, even though some people may think it does. If you think of rap as being about gangsters, violence, and macho sex, then the Dream Warriors record won't fit your expectations. The pop, jazz, and Caribbean rhythms might surprise you, too. My guest King Lou is the co-founder of the group and does all the raps on the record. He's from Jamaica, but he's been living in Toronto since he was a child. He grew up in a housing project where nearly everyone was from the islands. The Dream Warriors are in the U.S. on their first American tour. They're also recording a new record here. Their first album, And Now the Legacy Begins, was released in the U.S. over the summer. A couple of tracks had already been hits in England, including this one.
My definition of a bombastic jazz style. My definition is this.
Where is the music from behind you on My Definition?
There was a TV show called My Definition, and that's where we first heard it, but we didn't realize to use it until
song?
Later. Yeah, it's a theme song from this TV game show. It was like on a cheap channel, like Channel 10 back in Toronto. So when we were in England, they're playing this tune from this TV show called My Definition. But that's when we realized that it was actually music, and people could dance to this form of music, which was jazz. And when we went back home to, you know, construct this song that's called My Definition of a Bombastic Jazz Style, we realized that Quincy Jones originally did it.
So how did you start using the word bombastic? That's become like a word that's really associated with
well,
your group.
Well, bombastic comes from a Jamaican type of phrase, and it comes from a jazz phrase stick like bombastic. And it just means extremely good. Whatever your word meaning good is, it's one step above that. If you got a word like fresh, dope, fly, or whatever, bombastic is equivalent to that and more. So, you know, it's like you say Z, I say Z. Or you say, you know, stuff. That's exactly what it is. You say dope, I say bombastic. So it's just another way of bringing it. Plus, I'm from Jamaica. You know, I could talk potwap on the microphone, but still, a lot of people might not understand. So I speak in a type of manner that a lot of people can understand. I try to get to as much people as possible.
I think for a lot of people, when they think of rap, they think of the kind of gangster rap, like N.W.A. or Public Enemy, where the lyrics are kind of angry in a lot of ways, kind of politically charged, also about, like, scenes of gang violence. Mm-hmm. There's something really good-natured about a lot of the raps that you do.
Well, I think it's just done in our dialect, in our content. Everybody has their way of expressing it. If they're from a certain neighborhood that they must express it this way, they will. You know, we've been held down for years. And these were songs that were done many years ago. And I don't feel that I should change a baby that was done years ago to fit the 1990 criteria.
You mean you wrote these years ago?
Yeah. Wash Your Face in My Sink was written 6 years ago, if anybody knows the album. My definition of a boombastic jazz style was just a recent cut that we just did. But a lot of the songs in the album are like years back. Multiverse was like 6 years ago.
Well, you know,
the tracks on the album.
Part of what was happening 6 years ago were a lot of the raps were really just kind of very, very bragging about how great the rapper was.
That was the thing. And a lot of the songs that you hear from us, it's like, I like the song, but who are they? I don't even know their names because we never stated the names in the songs. We never stated where we came from. It was all those things that people used to grab and drop as prejudice. I don't like him because he thinks he's all about himself. I don't like him because he swears on every track. I don't like him because he's this. They couldn't get it from us. The only thing they could have really said was, these guys are really mellow, and I like loud, you know, songs and bragging songs, and a lot of the songs wasn't like that. It was just something that we were doing a long period of time ago because we used to do it just like everybody else, brag it and jump up on the mic and be really braggadocious and try to, you know, speak about ourselves, our neighborhood. And then we realized that life is much more than just a neighborhood. We went past speakers and sneakers.
My guest is King Lou of the rap group The Dream Warriors. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is King Lou of the rap group The Dream Warriors. Lou, let me ask you about another one of your raps that's on the Dream Warriors record, and this is Ludi.
Mm-hmm.
Let me play some of it first.
Yeah. My mother wanted me to make another song, something brand new so she could dance to too. So this one's dedicated to no other than my mother, my father, my sisters, and my brother. Or you could say the family, or better yet, the families. Oh, wait a sec, what the heck? This one's for Jamaica, Africa, Dominica, Trinidad and Tobago, St. Kitts, Bermuda, Antigua, St. Lucia, St. Martin's, and do not forget Montserrat, Nevis, Aruba, Grenada, Guyana, Cuba, St. Vincent, Anguilla, Bahamas, Puerto Rico, Curico, Dominican Republic, and Rio, Martinique and Guadeloupe, and Virgin Islands, truly. This one's for my mother when we were playing Lou.
What's the story behind this? This is dedicated to your mother?
Yeah, a lot of people felt that it was kind of like, you know, a little bit too rootsy or a little bit, you know, it's not as funky or as hip-hop, you know what I mean? It's not as jump-up. It's kind of like dance hall, kind of mellow. You just kind of listen to the groove and get into the sound. And we felt that was needed in the 90s, and it was needed in the time that we let it out. It's just, it was almost like too much chicken makes you want fish, you know what I mean? Or too much fish makes you want chicken.
The music
gave a different view.
The music behind you is pretty neat. I can't place it at all. This is one of your mother's dance records, or
yeah,
something?
It's one of my mother's old tunes that she liked.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of like we were doing so much stuff for us. It was time to do something for the people who brought us into this world, you know, kind of like respect your elders. A lot of people have been going the other way, and we felt that it's time to put back some respect to where respect is due. You know, and it's back in our parents. It's back in where we came from. It's back in our whole concept of life and living. You know, it's not every day you just talk about, you know, how where you're going and how to get there. You got to talk about where you came from. You know, and we don't just have to speak about, you know, the tribulations of coming up. We could speak about, you know, the way we're existing now. You know, we're here. It's working right now for us.
Ludi, which is the title of the rap, that's a game.
Yeah, that's an actual West Indian game. You guys call it Sori or Ludo, something like that. Ludo, it's like you just try to get this man around the board, and the middle section of it is called heaven. It's another equivalent for home. But the way the game plays is you try to get around this board and try to get it into heaven, and people land on your men and send you back, stuff like that. So it's actually like a more of a concept than just a couple of men rolling a dice, you know what I mean? So back in the West Indies, people made their own games because they didn't have a lot of money to go out and go to the store and buy one for $10.99. But, you know, now everybody up here manufactures it and sells it for $10.99, and everybody gets a yellow piece, everybody gets red pieces. You know, back in there, we used sticks and stones.
Do you still live with your mother?
Definitely.
You know, I can't think of another rapper who's done a song about his mother.
Yeah, I can't tell you another rapper who's done a song about the islands and named them off.
Right.
You know, so I get a lot of people that's, yeah, they're rappers and everything, but they're like, hey, man, I'm from St. Lucia. And you said St. Lucia on that track. I've never heard a song that dropped it like that. And that's just another way of, it's another piece of respect that nobody has caught from that person. And I think that's what we do, bring new views and grab new respects that you forgot.
There's been a lot of Jamaican rap records, and the kind of rhythms on the Jamaican rap records are really different than the rhythms on American rap records. And you kind of rap in that Jamaican style at the end of...
Well, I'm Jamaican.
Yeah,
you
right.
Know what I mean? So, like,
have you heard a lot of that?
Yeah.
Of the rap records?
I've heard a lot of people try to, you know, add some new concept to their songs, so they add a different flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of Americans or a lot of West Indians that move to America, for some reason, they kind of convert into this American. They link it up and they become American, you know. And like sometimes, for some reason, their kind of dreams get twisted. It's like, I want to go to America. I want to go to America. They get to America and they want to become more financially richer, and that kind of changes their views a little bit. Oh, don't get me wrong. I do know a lot of people that moved up here and they still keep the culture alive in what they do, you know. But in Canada, for some reason, it's a multicultural country. Very, 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 very strong West Indian, you know, community. So we have a lot of West Indians growing up there, and they tend to keep it alive much more.
How old were you when you moved from Jamaica to Toronto?
Jeez, I was like, you know, kicking cans. I was like just a kid. And, you know, my mother grew me up under the same roof as she would in Jamaica. So it's not like we left it. We brought a piece with us, and everybody seemed to bring a piece with us. So in our community, you know, the West Indian culture kept going. So it's not something like when you come to the areas that we grew up in, you'll see what I mean. You'll look at the buildings and the buildings look like concrete jungles, but it's still the West Indian community is still in there. You go into anybody's house, and right away you'll get the West Indian feel.
Now, I read a story about how you approached the person who became your producer,
mm-hmm.
and
manager.
Manager. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah, you approached him. Pushed him at a party and started rapping to him. What's the story?
Yeah, let me get into that. We actually went to the girls' washroom. So you saw all the girls out there.
What were you doing in the ladies' room?
What happened was, we had a lot of back when we used to write and stuff like that. Speaking a word, you know, out in the open was kind of like means for another rapper to grab a new lingo that you had or a new phrase or something. So, you know, we chose the girl in the girls' washroom because a lot of fellas were in there, and they, like, you know, didn't want them to get into the lyrics that we were doing. So we were going to give them the new slap, and the new slap was Multiverse back in that day. And we brought them into the girls' washroom, and we rapped a track for them because Mishy Me from Mishy Me and L.A. Love, that was their manager. This was the first time I had ever met Ivan Berry, the manager, because we used to write and produce for Mishy and Love. And what happened was, after when they took us in the washroom, we started rapping a song to them. It was a cappella, and he was so in love with the lyrics and the content, and the flow, that was history. That was it. We had something that a lot of the other artists didn't. They were talking about their sneakers, their hat, you know, how big their gun was, you know, how hard they could slap you, or, you know, how far they can reach, you know, how much money they got in their pockets. And
which rap did you do for Ivan Berry in the ladies' room?
Multiverse. The beginning starts, modern technology, warriors in mythology. We rule the multiverse, we're infinity, echoing in the minds of the suckers I be crushing now. A step after step, dream warriors for this age. Pulsating, vibrating mental stimulation, attached with the amp, to keep you vibrating. Anticipating rules, my bass bounce all over. Giving me the vibe so your butt be ruined, lad. I am a mega, and you're a micro. I got style and born to rock ghettos. Or you could say projects, your satellite complex. I work the strings, you're just a marionette. Made by Geppetto, so you're a Pinocchio. You could beat me, your lying, your nose is growing, showing. Me that you're unclean, not fit to rock scenes. You need practice, you know what I mean? A simple rapper like yourself can be unwrapped. You will be tired as hell, so you can't go relapse. I got strength. I get ovated and encored. That's why my rhymes keep excelling like Concords. Breaking sound barriers, strong like Bull Terriers. Come join the party. The more, the merrier, stereo. Turn me on, bubble up, like 7-Up in a cup. Some say it's a curse. The we are the rulers of the multiverse. So it's like a message. It's a rap we're talking about. You know what I mean? Music underneath it just carries it and gives you a melody and gives you something to swing to. You know, and that's all it is. Just ain't no big thing. No stars, no stardom. Stage is street.
Any girls walk in the middle of that?
Yeah, see, that's the thing. You see, it's not girls, it's not boys, it's people.
No. In the ladies' room, it's girls.
Yeah?
I mean, in the ladies' room when you were doing the rap. Did any girls walk in?
Unfortunately not.
You've made some pretty unusual choices in the records that you've used, and I forget on which one it is, but there's just like a few bars of a walking bass from I don't know which jazz record. I couldn't place it.
See, that's the thing. It may sound like a jazz record, but it could be from a rock record, or it could be even from rockers. You know what I mean? So that was the big thing with the album. People didn't know what part of the galaxy it was from. You know what I mean? But they could pinpoint feelings when they heard Now the Legacy Begins. It sounded like it was back in the Sugar Hill days. Then they heard Multiverse, and it sounded like it was on Mars. Then they heard My Definition, and it sounded like it came from the South. Something like, you know what I mean? So then they heard Ludi, and it sounded like it was somewhere in the islands. It was like, where are these guys from? And they couldn't pinpoint it. They listened to the name. They looked at the name of the group, Dream Warriors. It didn't even sound like a rap group name. So that was the big thing. It was like, we weren't the typical everyday hip-hop, bebop, b-boy.
King Lou of the Dream Warriors. Tonight, the Dream Warriors end their first American tour. Here's more from their record, and Now the Legacy Begins.
Hello?
What time is it?
Here I go, here I go again.
Wake up in the morning. Wake up in the morning.
Can't wash your face in my sink. Sink. Gentlemen, it's now the time.
This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, the treaty that was supposed to create a new kind of union between and among some of the republics of the Soviet Union was supposed to be signed today, and it was not. We'll have a story on that. We have the first of what we hope will be a complete set of serious conversations with possible presidential candidates today. Noah Adams is talking to Paul Tsongas of Massachusetts. We're also going to take a look at a catalog where you can order all kinds of exotic food, and we're going to continue to talk with our visiting chef on Thanksgiving desserts.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tonight on CBS, the network's second annual Classic Weekend of TV Retrospectives concludes with Memories of MASH, a 90-minute special that TV critic David Bianculli says is the best retrospective yet. He has this review.
Normally, I'd rather encourage TV to make new shows than mount specials about old ones. But MASH is one of the best sitcoms TV ever made, period. No argument. So any show that throws together a bunch of its best moments and revisits the actors and creators has got to be good. But Memories of MASH is better than good. Like Hawkeye Pierce, it's fast, it's funny, and it's clever. Michael Hirsch, who produced a documentary called Making MASH back when MASH was still on the air, is the writer, producer, and director of this special. He's the right guy for the job, too, because he not only knows the subject well, but he can ask questions and organize material like a true documentary filmmaker. In Memories of MASH, Hirsch talks to all the major cast members and also interviews the show's producers and some of its writers and supporting players. He visits them individually, so technically this isn't even a reunion show. But by talking privately, the actors sometimes say things they probably wouldn't have said in the giddy glow of group nostalgia. For example, you have McLean Stevenson and Gary Berghoff, who played Henry Blake and Radar O'Reilly, talking separately and candidly about the last scene they filmed together, the scene in which Henry, who's finished his tour of duty, says goodbye and flies away in a helicopter.
And I remember standing there looking at Radar. And again, I go back to the father-son thing, and I just hugged him. I think it was a way of saying I love you.
I was honoring McLean, not just his character, but McLean when I saluted him. And when he embraced me, I honestly believed that that was McLean embracing Gary. It was a very touching and difficult moment for us. This is stuff that I hadn't even thought about for 15 years, and it's still... I didn't realize that I would be that still emotionally involved with it. I'm glad I am, though. It's nice to know that I remember, too.
In the script, that helicopter crashed, Henry Blake died, and so did Stevenson's career. He had asked out of the series, gotten his wish, and hasn't found a good role since, while the show adapted nicely without him. Ironically, the host of Memories of MASH is Shelley Long, who played a nurse in a 1979 MASH episode. She left Cheers under such similar circumstances that I awarded her that year's McLean Stevenson Memorial I'm Gonna Quit This Show and Become a Big Star Award. Memories of MASH doesn't provide that sort of perspective, but it does talk about how the show pioneered the mixture of comedy and drama on sitcom TV and where some of its best ideas came from. One of my favorite episodes was The Interview, a show in which the actors ad-libbed their own dialogue as journalist Cleet Roberts asked them questions for a black-and-white TV documentary. Writer-producer Larry Gelbart explains that the show was based on Edward R. Murrow's 1952 show, Christmas in Korea. And listen to Roberts asking a question of Larry Linville's Frank Burns, Mike Farrell's B.J. Honeycutt, and William Christopher's Father Mulcahy.
Has this whole experience changed you in any way?
Certainly not.
When I first came here, I couldn't walk down a corridor full of wounded people without being sickened by it, and now I can walk down without noticing them.
When the doctors cut into a patient, and it's cold, you know, the way it is now, today, steam rises from the body. And the doctor will warm himself over the open wound. Could anyone look on that and not feel changed?
There are about 10 other clips I'd like to play, which is a good indication of how strong and informative this retrospective really is. This special is no mishmash, but it will make you mishmash.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landerl, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Roberta Shurrock and Sue Weinstein. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Stephen Wilmson about his new book, Silverado, Neil Bush and the Savings and Loan Scandal. Wilmson broke the story of Bush's conflict of interest while Bush served on Silverado's board of directors. Also, Digesting the Child Within, the sick humor of cartoonist John Callahan. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.